Fuck off, you sexist cunt, the rent boy says. I'm tempted to ignore the bastard. Mates are a waste of fucking time. They are always ready to drag you down to their level of social, sexual and intellectual mediocrity. I'd better dismiss the Raj, though, in case he thinks he's got one up on us. The fact that you use the term cunt in the same breath as sexist shows that you display the same muddled, fucked-up thinking on this issue as you do on everything else. That Scooby's the cunt. He says something biscuit-erst in reply, in a pathetic attempt to salvage the situation. Rent boy nil, Simon one. We both know it. Renton, Renton, what's the score? The Bridges is hoaching with Minge. Ooh, ooh la la, let's go dancing. Ooh, ooh la la, Simon dancing. There is Fanny of every race, colour, creed and nationality present. Oh ya country. It's time to move. Two Oriental types consulting a map. Simon Express, that'll do nicely. Fuck Rents, he's a DOS bastard, totally US. Can I help you? Where are you headed? I ask. Good old-fashioned Scottish hospitality, aye, you can't beat it, says a young Sean Connery, the new Bond, 'cause girls, this is the new bondage. We're looking for the Royal Mile, a posh English colonial voice answers back in my face. What the fucking wee pump up the knickers on all? Simple Simon says, put your hands on your feet. Of course, the rent boy is looking like a flaccid prick in a barrel load of fannies. Sometimes I really think the gadge still believes that an erection is for pishing over high walls. Follow us. Are you going to a show? Yes, you can't beat the festival for bringing out the Mantovani. Yes, one of the China dolls hands us a piece of paper with Brecht, the Caucasian Chalk Circle by Nottingham University Theatre Group on it. Doubtless a collection of zit-encrusted, squeaky-voiced wankers playing out a miserable pretension to the arts before graduating to work in the power stations which give the local children leukemia, or investment consultancies which shut down factories, throwing people into poverty and despair. Still, let's get the board treading out of the system first. Fucking tossbags, don't you agree, Sean? My old fellow former milk-delivering mucker? Yes, Simon, I think you may have a strong point there. Old Sean and I have so many parallels. Both the Dyna lads, both ex-co-op milk boys. I only did the Leith run, whereas Sean, if you listen to any old fucker, delivered milk to every household in the city. Child labour laws were more lax then, I suppose. One area in which we differ is looks. Sean is completely outshone in that department by Simon. Now Rents is gibbering on about Galileo and Mother Courage and Baal and all that shite. The bitches seem quite impressed, I know. Why, fuck me, insensible. This DOS cunt actually does have his uses. It's an amazing world. Yes, Simon, the more I see, the less I believe. You and me both, Sean. The Oriental Mantos depart to the show, but they've agreed to meet us for a drink in Deacon's afterwards. Rents, can he make it? Boo-fucking-who? I'll cry myself to sleep. He's meeting Ms. Mogadon, the lovely Hazel. I'll just have to amuse both chickies, if I decide to show up. I'm a busy man. One must put duty first, eh, Sean? Precisely, Simon. A shake-off, Rents. He can go and kill himself with drugs. Some fucking friends I have. Spud, Second Prize, Begbie, Matty, Tommy. These punters spell L-I-M-I-T-E-D. An extremely limited company. Well, I'm fed up to my back teeth with losers, no-hopers, draft packs, schemies, junkies and the likes. I am a dynamic young man, upwardly mobile and thrusting, thrusting, thrusting. The socialists go on about your comrades, your class, your union and society. Fuck all that shite. The Tories go on about your employer, your country, your family. Fuck that even mayor. It's me. Me. Fucking me. Simon David Williamson. Numero fucking uno. Versus the world. And it's a one-sided swedge. It's really so fucking easy. Fuck them all. I admire your rampant individualism, Simon. I see parallels with myself as a young man. Glad you shed that, Sean. Others have made similar comments. Yuck. A spotty fucker in a heart scarf. Yes, the cunts are at home today. Look at 'em. The ultimate anti-style statement. I'd rather see my sister in a brothel than my brother in a heart scarf, and that's fucking true. Yup, another strapping lass ahead. Backpacker, good tan. Suck, fuck, suck, fuck. We all fall down. Where to go? Work up a sweat in the multi-gym at the club. They've got a sauna and a sunbed now. Get the muscles toned up. The smack heebie-jeebies are now just an unpleasant memory. The chinky chickies, Marianne, Andrea, Ali, which lucky ride will I stick it into the night? Who's the best fuck? Why, me, of course. I might even find something at the club. The dynamics are magic. Three groups, women, straight guys and gay guys. The gay guys are cruising the straight guys who are club bouncer types with huge biceps and beer guts. The straight guys are cruising the women who are into the lithe, fit, buffety boys. No bastard actually gets what they want, except Ash, eh, Sean? Precisely, Simon. I hope I don't see the buffety that cruised us the last time I was in. He told me in the cafeteria that he had HIV. But things were cool. It was no death sentence. He'd never felt better. What kind of a cunt tells a stranger that? It's probably bullshit. Sleazy fucking queen. That reminds us. I must buy some flunkies. Bah, there's no way you can get HIV in Edinburgh through shagging a lassie. They say that wee Gogsy got it that way, but I reckon he's been doing a bit of mainlining or shit-stabbing on the QT. If you didn't get it through shooting up with the likes of Renton, Spud, Swanee and Seeker, it's obviously no got your name on it. Still, why tempt fate? But why not? At least I know that I'm still here, still alive, because as long as there's an opportunity to get off with a woman and her purse, and that's it, that is it, I've found fuck all else, zero, to fill this big black hole like a clenched fist in the centre of my fucking chest. Chapter 4. Growing up in public. Despite the unmistakable resentment she could feel from her mother, Nina could not fathom what she had done wrong. The signals were confusing. First it was, keep out of the way. Then, don't just stand there. A group of relatives had formed a human wall around her Auntie Alice. Nina could not actually see Alice from where she was sitting, but the fussing coos coming from across the room told her that her aunt was in there somewhere. Her mother caught her eye. She was staring over at Nina, looking like one of the heads on a hydra. Over the there-theres and the he-was-a-good-mans, Nina saw her mother mouth the word tea. She tried to ignore the signal, but her mother hissed insistently, aiming her words across the room at Nina like a fine jet. Make more tea. Nina threw her copy of the NME onto the floor. She hauled herself out of the armchair and moved over to a large dining table. picking up a tray on which sat a teapot and an almost empty jug of milk. Through in the kitchen, she studied her face in the mirror, focusing on a spot above her top lip. Her black hair, cut in a sloping wedge, looked greasy, although she had just washed it the night before. She rubbed her stomach, feeling bloated with fluid retention. Her period was due. It was a bummer. Nina could not be a part of this strange festival of grief. The whole thing seemed uncool. The act of casual indifference she displayed at her Uncle Andy's death was only partly feigned. He had been her favourite relative when she was a wee lassie, and he had made her laugh, or so they all told her. And in a sense, she could remember it. These events had happened, the joking, the tickling, the playing, the indulgent supply of ice creams and sweeties. She could find no emotional connection, though, between the her of now and the her of then, and therefore no emotional connection to Andy. To hear her relatives recount these days of infancy and childhood made her squirm with embarrassment. It seemed an essential denial of herself as she was now. Worse, it was uncool. At least she was dressed for grief, as she was constantly reminded by everyone. She thought that her relatives were so boring. They held on to the mundane for grim life. It was a glum adhesive binding them together.
"That lassie never wears anything but black. In my day, lassies wore nice bright colours, instead of trying to look like vampires."
Uncle Bob, fat, stupid Uncle Bob, had said that. The relatives had laughed, every one of them. Stupid, petty laughter. The nervous laughter of frightened children trying to keep on the right side of the school hard case, rather than that of adults conveying that they had heard something funny. Nina consciously realized for the first time that laughter was about more than humor. This was about reducing tension, solidarity in face of the Grim Reaper. Andy's death had put that topic further up the list of items on the personal agenda of every one of them. The kettle clicked off. Nina made another pot of tea and took it through. "Never mind, Alice. Never mind, Hen. Here's Nina with the tea," her Auntie Avril said. Nina thought that perhaps unrealistic expectations were being invested in the PG tips. Could they be expected to compensate for the loss of a 24-year relationship?
"Terrible thing when you get problems with a ticker," her Uncle Kenny stated.
"Still, at least he didn't suffer. Better than the big sea, rotting away in agony. Your father went with the ticker and all. The curse of the Fitzpatricks. That's your grandfather."
He looked at Nina's cousin Malcolm and smiled. Although Malcolm was Kenny's nephew, he was only 4 years younger than his uncle and looked older.
"Someday, all this ticker stuff and cancer and that will all be forgotten about," Malcolm ventured.
"Oh, aye, medical science."
"How's your Elsa, by the way?" Kenny's voice dropped.
"She's gone in for another op. Fallopian tube job. Apparently what they do is..."
Nina turned and left the room. All Malcolm seemed to want to talk about were the operations his wife had undergone to enable them to produce a child. The details made the tips of her fingers feel raw. Why did people assume that you wanted to hear that stuff? What sort of woman would go through all that just to produce a screaming brat? What sort of man would encourage her to do that? As she went to the hall, the doorbell rang. It was her Auntie Cathy and Uncle Davy. They had made good time from Leith out to Bonnyrigg. Cathy hugged Nina.
"Oh, darling, where is she? Where's Alice?"
Nina liked her Auntie Cathy. She was the most outgoing of her aunts, and treated her like a person rather than a child. Kathy went over and hugged Alice, her sister-in-law, then her sister Irene, Nina's mother, and her brothers Kenny and Bob, in that order. Nina thought that the order was tasteful. Davy nodded sternly at everybody.
"Christ, you didn't waste any time getting out here in that old van, Davy," Bob said.
"Aye, the bypass makes a difference. Pick it up just outside Portobello. Get off just before Bonnyrigg," Davy explained dutifully.
The bell went again. This time it was Dr. Sim, the family GP. Sim was alert and businesslike in stance, but somber in expression. In his bearing, he attempted to convey a measure of compassion, while still maintaining a pragmatic strength in order to give the family confidence. Sim thought he wasn't doing badly. Nina also thought so. A horde of breathless aunties fussed over him like groupies around a rock star. After a short time, Bob, Kenny, Kathy, Davy and Irene accompanied Dr. Sim upstairs. Nina realized, as they began to leave the room, that her period had started. She followed them up the stairs.
"Stay out the way,"
Irene, looking back, hissed at her daughter.
"I'm just going to the toilet,"
Nina replied, indignant. In the lavatory, she took off her clothes, starting with her black, lacy gloves. Examining the extent of the damage, she noted that the discharge had gone through her knickers but had not got into her black leggings.
"Shite,"
she said, as drops of thick, dark blood fell onto the bathroom carpet. She tore off a few strips of toilet paper and held them to her in order to stem the flow. She then checked the bathroom cabinet, but could find no tampons or sanitary towels. Was Alice too old for periods? Probably. Soaking some more paper with water, she managed to get most of the stains out of the carpet. Nina stepped tentatively into the shower. After splashing herself, she made another pad from bog roll and quickly dressed, leaving off her pants, which she washed in the sink, wrung out and stuffed into her jacket pocket. She squeezed the spot above her top lip and felt much better. Nina heard the entourage leaving the room and going downstairs. This place was the fucking dregs, she thought, and she wanted out. All she had been waiting for was an opportune moment to hit her mother for cash. She was supposed to be going into Edinburgh with Shona and Tracy to see this band at the Carlton Studios. She didn't fancy going out when she was on her periods, as Shona had said that laddies can tell when you're on. They can just smell it, no matter what you do. Shona knew about laddies. She was a year younger than Nina, but had done it twice. Once with Graham Redpath, and once with a French boy she'd met at Aviemore. Nina had not been with anyone yet, had not done it. Almost everyone she knew said it was crap. Boys were too stupid, too morose and dull, or too excitable. She enjoyed the effect she had on them, liked seeing the frozen, simpleton expressions on their faces as they watched her. When she did it, she would do it with someone who knew what they were about, someone older, but not like Uncle Kenny, who looked at her as if he was a dog, his eyes bloody and his tongue darting slyly over his lips. She had a strange feeling that Uncle Kenny, despite his years, would be a bit like the inept boys that Shona and the rest had been with. Despite her reservations about going to the gig, the alternative was staying in and watching television. Specifically, this meant Bruce Forsyth's Generation Game with her mother and her silly wee fart of a brother, who always got excited when the stuff came down the conveyor belt and recited the items quickly in his squeaky, quirky voice. Her mum wouldn't even let her smoke in the living room. She let Dougie, her moronic man friend, smoke in the living room. That was all right, considered to be the subject matter of light humour rather than the cause of cancer and heart disease. Nina, however, had to go upstairs for a fag, and that was the pits. Her room was cold, and by the time she'd switched on the heating and it warmed up, she could have smoked a packet of 20 Marlboro. Fuck all that for a laugh. Tonight, she'd take her chances at the gig. Leaving the bathroom, Nina looked in on Uncle Andy. The corpse lay in the bed, the covers still over it. They might have closed his mouth, she thought. It looked as if he'd expired drunkenly, belligerently, frozen by death as he was arguing about football or politics. The body was skinny and wizened, but then again Andy always was. She remembered being tickled in the ribs by these persistent, ubiquitous, bony fingers. Perhaps Andy was always dying. Nina decided to rake through the drawers to see if Alice had any knickers worth borrowing. Andy's socks and Y-fronts were in the top section of a chest of drawers. Alice's undies were in the next one down. Nina was startled by the range of underwear Alice had. They ranged from outsized garments which Nina held against her and which almost came down to her knees, to skimpy, lacy briefs she could never imagine her auntie wearing. One pair were made of the same material as the black lace gloves Nina had. She removed the gloves to feel the pants. Although she liked these ones, she picked a pink flowery pair, then went back into the bathroom to put them on. When she got downstairs, she noted that alcohol had displaced tea as the gathering's principal social lubricant. Dr. Sims stood, whiskey in hand, talking to Uncle Kenny, Uncle Bob and Malcolm. She wondered if Malcolm would be asking him about fallopian tubes. The men were all drinking with a stoic determination, as if it were a serious duty. Despite the grief, there was no disguising the sense of relief in the air. This was Andy's third heart attack, and now that he had finally checked out, they could get on with their lives without jumping nervously whenever they heard Alice's voice on the phone. Another cousin, Jeff, Malky's brother, had arrived. He looked at Nina with something she felt was akin to hate. It was unnerving and strange. He was a wanker, though. All Nina's cousins were, the ones she knew at any rate. Her Auntie Kathy and Uncle Davy, he was from Glasgow and a Protestant, had two sons, Billy, who had just come out of the army, and Mark, who was supposed to be into drugs. They were not here, as they hardly knew Andy or any of the Bonnie Rigg crowd. They would probably be at the funeral. Or perhaps not. Kathy and Davy once had a third son, also called Davy, who had died almost a year ago. He was badly mentally and physically handicapped, and had lived most of his life in a hospital. Nina had only seen him once, sitting twisted in a wheelchair, mouth open and eyes vacant. She wondered how Kathy and Davy must have felt about his death. Again, sad, but perhaps also relieved. Shite. Jeff was coming over to talk to her. She had once pointed him out to Shona, who said that he looked like Marty from Wet Wet Wet. Nina hated both Marty and the Wets, and anyway thought that Jeff was nothing like him. All right, Nina.
Aye, it's a shame about Uncle Andy.
Aye, what can you say? Jeff shrugged his shoulders. He was 21, and Nina thought that was ancient.
So, when do you finish the school? He asked her.
Next year.
I wanted to go now, but my ma hassled us to stay.
Taking O grades?
Aye.
Which ins?
English, maths, arithmetic, art, accounts, physics, modern studies.
Gonna pass them?
Aye. It's not that hard.
Except maths.
Then what?
Get a job.
Or get on a scheme.
No gonna stay on and take hires?
No.
You should. You could go to university.
What for?
Jeff had to think for a while. He had recently graduated with a degree in English literature and was on the dole. So were most of his fellow graduates.
It's a good social life, he said.
Nina recognised that the look Jeff had been given her was not one of hate, but of lust. He'd obviously been drinking before he had arrived, and his inhibitions were lowered.
You're really grown, Nina, he said.
Aye, she blushed, knowing she was doing it and hating herself for it. Fancy getting out of here? I mean, can you get into pubs? We could go out of the road for a drink.
Nina weighed up the offer.
Even if Jeff talked student shite, it had to be better than staying here. They would be seen in the pub by somebody, this was Bonnyrigg, and somebody would talk. Shona and Tracy would find out, and would want to know who this dark older guy was. It was too good an opportunity to miss.
Then Nina remembered the gloves. Absent-mindedly, she had left them on the top of the chest of drawers in Andy's room. She excused herself from Jeff.
"Aye, all right then. I'm just gone up to the toilet."
The gloves were still on top of the chest. She picked them up and put them in her jacket pocket. But her wet pants were there, so she quickly removed the gloves and put them in the other one. She looked around at Andy.
There was something different about him. He was sweating. She saw him twitch. God, she was sure she saw him twitch. She touched his hand. It was warm. Nina ran downstairs. "It's Uncle Andy, I think. You should come. It's like he's still there."
They looked at her with incredulous expressions. Kenny was first to react, springing up the stairs three at a time, followed by Davy and Dr. Sim. Alice twitched nervously, open-mouthed, but not really taking it in.
"He was a good man. Never lifted his hands to me,"
she moaned deliriously. Something inside her drove her to follow the herd upstairs. Kenny felt his brother's sweaty brow and his hand.
"He's burning up! Andy's no deed! Andy's no deed!"
Sim was about to examine the figure when he was pushed aside by Alice, who, having broken free of her constraints, fell upon the warm, pyjama-clad body.
"Andy! Andy! Can you hear me?"
Andy's head bobbed to the side, his stupid, frozen expression never changing, his body remaining limp. Nina giggled nervously. Alice was seized and held like a dangerous psychotic. Men and women cooed and made soothing noises at her as Dr. Sim examined Andy.
"No, I'm sorry. Mr. Fitzpatrick is dead. His heart has stopped," Sim said gravely.
He stood back and put his hand under the bedclothes. He then bent down and pulled a plug out of the wall. He picked up a white flex and pulled a hand switch, which was attached to it, out from under the bed.
"Someone left the electric blanket on. That explains the warmth of the body and the sweating," he announced.
"Deary me! Christ almighty!" Kenny laughed.
He saw Jeff's eyes blazing at him. In self-justification, he said,
"Andy would be pishing his sail. You ken what a sense of humour Andy had."
He turned his palms outwards.
"You're a fucking arse. There's Alice here," Jeff stammered, enraged, before turning and bolting from the room.
Jeff, wait there now, mate,"
Kenny pleaded. They heard the slamming of the front door. Nina thought that she would piss herself. Her sides ached as she struggled to repress the spasms of laughter which shook through her. Kathy put her arm around her.
"It's all right, darling. There you go, hen. Dinna worry yourself," she said, as Nina realised she was crying like a baby. Crying with a raw power and unself-conscious abandon as the tensions ebbed from her body and she became limp in Kathy's arms. Memories, sweet childhood memories, flooded her consciousness. Memories of Andy and Alice and the happiness and love that once lived here in the home of her auntie and uncle.
Chapter 5. Victory on New Year's Day.
"Happy New Year, you wee cunt!"
Franco wrapped his arm around Stevie's head. Stevie felt several neck muscles tear. As stiff, sober and self-conscious, he struggled to go with the flow. He returned the greeting as heartily as he could. There followed a round of Happy New Years. His tentative hands crushed, his stiff back snapped, his tight and unresponsive lips kissed. All he could think of was the phone, London, and Stella. She hadn't phoned. Worse, she hadn't been in when he phoned. Not even at her mother's. Stevie had gone back to Edinburgh and left the field clear for Keith Millard. The bastard would take full advantage. They'd be together right now, just like they probably were last night. Millard was a slag. So was Stevie. So was Stella. It was a bad combination. Stella was also the most wonderful person in the world in Stevie's eyes. That fact made her less of a slag. In fact, not a slag at all.
"Loosen up, for fuck's sake, it's new fucking year!"
Franco not so much suggested as commanded. That was his way. People would be forced to enjoy themselves if necessary. It generally wasn't necessary. They were all frighteningly high. It was difficult for Stevie to reconcile this world with the one he'd just left. Now he was aware of them looking at him. Who were they, these people? What did they want? The answer was that they were his friends and they wanted him. A song on the turntable drilled into his consciousness, adding to his misery. I loved a lassie, a bonny, bonny lassie. She's as sweet as the heather in the glen. She's as sweet as the heather, the bonny purple heather, Mary, my Scots blue bell. They all joined in with gusto.
Can he beat Harry Lauder? It new year, like say,
Dawsey remarked. In the joy of the faces around him, Stevie gained a measurement of his own misery. The pit of melancholy was a bottomless one, and he was descending fast, falling further away from the good times. Such times often seemed tantalizingly within reach. He could see them, going on all around him. His mind was like a cruel prison, giving his captive soul a sight of freedom, but no more. Stevie sipped his can of export and hoped that he could get through the night without bringing too many people down. Frank Begbie was the main problem. It was his flat, and he was determined that everyone was going to have a good time.
I got your ticket for the match tonight, Stevie. Into the jambo cunts, Renton said to him. Nobody watching it in the pub. I thought it was on satellite, like say.
Sick boy, who'd been chatting up a small dark-haired girl Stevie didn't know, turned to him.
Get to fuck, Stevie. You're picking up some bad habits doing in London, I'm telling you, man. I fucking detest televised football. It's like shagging with a Durex on. Say fucking sex, say fucking football, say fucking everything. Let's all build a nice, safe wee world around us, he mocked, his face contorting.
Stevie had forgotten the extent of Sick Boy's natural outrage. Rents agreed with Sick Boy. That was unusual, thought Stevie. They were always slagging each other off. Generally, if one said sugar, the other said shite.
They should ban all football on the telly and get the lazy fat fucks off their arses and along to the games.
"'You've talked us into it,' Stevie said in resigned tones. The unity between Rents and Sick Boy didn't last.
"'You can talk about getting off your arse, Mr. Fucking Couch Tatty's cell. "'Keep off the H for more than 10 minutes and you might make more games this season than you did the last one,' Sick Boy sneered. "'You've got a fucking nerve, you cunt,'
Rents turned to Stevie, then flicked his thumb derisively in Sick Boy's direction.
They were calling this cunt Boots because of the drugs he was carrying.
They bickered on. Stevie would once have enjoyed this. Now it was draining him.
Remember, Stevie, I'll be staying with you for a bit in February,
Rents said to him. Stevie nodded grimly. He'd been hoping Rents had forgotten all about this, or would drop it. Rents was a mate, but he had a problem with drugs. In London he'd be straight back on the gear again, teaming up with Tony and Nixie. They were always sorting out addresses where they could pick up gyros from. Rents never seemed to work, but always seemed to have money. The same with Sick Boy. But he treated everybody else's cash as his own, and his own in exactly the same way.
"Pertie at Matty's after the game. His new place in Lorne Street. Be there sharp," Frank Begbie shouted over at them.
Another party. It was almost like work to Stevie. New Year will go on and on. It'll start to fade about the 4th, when the gaps between the parties start to appear. These gaps get bigger until they become the normal week, with the parties happening at the weekend. More first foots arrived. The small flat was heaving. Stevie had never seen Franco, the beggar, so at ease with himself. Rab McLaughlin, or Second Prize, as they called him, hadn't even been assaulted when he'd pished up the back of Begbie's curtains. Second Prize had been incoherently drunk for weeks now. New Year was a convenient camouflage for people like him. His girlfriend, Carol, had stormed off in protest at his behaviour. Second Prize hadn't even realised that she was there in the first place. Stevie moved into the kitchen, where it was quieter, and he had at least a chance of hearing the phone. Like a yuppie businessman, he'd left a list of the numbers where he was likely to be at with his mother. She could pass these on to Stella, if she phoned. Stevie had told her how he felt about her, in that ugly barn of a pub in Kentish Town, the one they never usually drank in. He laid his heart bare. Stella had said that she would have to think about what he said, that it had really freaked her out and was too much to handle right now. She said she would phone him when he got back up to Scotland, and that was that. They left the pub, going in separate directions. Stevie went towards the tube station to get the underground to King's Cross, sports bag over his shoulder. He stopped, turned, and watched her cross the bridge. Her long brown curls swished wildly in the wind as she walked away clad in her donkey jacket, short skirt, thick black woolen tights, and 9-inch Dr. Martens. He waited for her to glance back at him. She never turned around. Stevie bought a bottle of Bell's whiskey at the station and had arsed the lot by the time the train rolled into Waverley. His mood hadn't improved since then. He sat on the Formica worktop, contemplating the kitchen tiles. June, Franco's girlfriend, came in and smiled at him, nervously fetching some drinks. June never spoke, and often seemed overwhelmed by such occasions. Franco spoke enough for both of them. As June left, Nicola came in, being pursued by Spud, who trailed behind her like a faithful, salivating dog.
Hey, Stevie, Happy New Year, Alexei, Spud drawled.
I've seen you, Spud. We were up the Tron together last night, remember?
Oh, right. Hang loose, cat boy, Spud focused, grabbing a full bottle of cider.
All right, Stevie. How's London? Nicola asked.
God, no, thought Stevie. Nicola is too easy to talk to. I'm going to pour my heart out. No, I'm not. Yes, I am. Stevie started talking.
Nicola listened indulgently. Spud nodded sympathetically, occasionally indicating that the whole scene was too fucking heavy.
He felt that he was making an arse of himself, but he couldn't stop talking. What a bore he must be to Nicola, to Spud even, but he couldn't stop.
Spud eventually left, to be replaced by Kelly. Linda joined them. The football songs must be starting up in the front room. Nicola dispensed some practical advice. Phone her. Wait for her to phone, or go down and see her.
Stevie, mod through ya cunt!
Begbie roared. Stevie tamely allowed himself to be literally dragged back into the front room.
Fucking chatting up the Mantovani in the fucking kitchen. You're fucking worse than that smarmy cunt there, the fucking jazz purist.
He gestured over at Sick Boy, who was necking with the woman he'd been chatting up. They had previously overheard Sick Boy describe himself to her as basically a jazz purist.
So we're off to Dublin in the green, fuck the Queen, where the helmets glisten in the sun, fuck the Huns, and the bayonets slash the orange sash to the echo of the Thompson gun.
Stevie sat gloomily. The phone would never be heard above this noise.
Shut up the now, shouted Tommy. This is my favourite song.
The Wolf Tones sang Bannerstrand. Tommy crooned along with some of the others. On the Lochhorn lay Bannerstrand. There were a few moist eyes when the Tones sang James Connolly.
A fucking great rebel, a fucking great socialist, and a fucking great hippie. James fucking Connolly, you cunt,
Gav said to Renton, who nodded somberly. Some sang along, others tried to maintain conversations above the music. However, when the Boys of the Old Brigade came on, everybody joined in. Even Sick Boy took time off his necking session.
Oh, Father, why are you so sad on this fine Easter morn? Sing, you cunt, said Tommy, elbowing Stevie's ribs.
Begbie stuck another can of beer in his hand and threw his arm around his neck.
When Irishmen are proud and glad at the land where they were born.
Stevie worried about the singing. It had a desperate edge to it. It was as if, by singing loudly enough, they would weld themselves into a powerful brotherhood. It was, as the song said, call-to-arms music, and seemed to have little to do with Scotland and New Year. It was fighting music. Stevie didn't want to fight anyone. But it was also beautiful music. Hangovers, while being pushed into the background by the drink, were also being fueled. They were now so potentially big as to be genuinely feared. They would not stop drinking until they had to face the music, and that was when every bit of adrenaline had been burned away.
Oh, on being just a lad like you, I joined the IRA. Professional wing!
The phone rang in the passage. June got it. Then Begbie snatched it out of her hand, ushering her away. She floated back into the living room like a ghost.
Whee? Whee? Where's that? Stevie? Right, how doing the now? Happy New Year, doll, by the way.
Franco put the receiver down.
Whoever the fuck you are.
He went through to the front room.
Stevie, some fucking lemon on the blower for you. Fucking bulls in the mouth, like, say, London. Faw, ya cunchy,
Tommy laughed as Stevie sprang out off the couch. He had needed a pee for the last half hour, but hadn't trusted his legs. Now they worked perfectly.
Steve?
She had always called him Steve rather than Stevie. They all did down there.
Where have you been?
Stella, where have I been? I tried to phone you yesterday. Where are you? What are you doing?
He almost said, who are you with, but he restrained himself.
I was at Lynn's, she told him.
Of course, her sister's. Chingford, or some equally dull and hideous place. Stevie felt a euphoric surge.
Happy New Year, he said,
relieved and brimming over. The pips went, then more change was put into the machine. Stella was not at home. Where was she? In a pub with Millard?
Happy New Year, Steve. I'm at King's Cross. I'm getting on the Edinburgh train in 10 minutes. Can you meet me at the station at 10:45?
Fucking hell! You're joking. Fuck!
There's nowhere else in the world I'll be at 10:45. You've made my New Year, Stella.
The things I says the other night, I mean them more than ever, you know.
That's good, because I think I'm in love with you. All I've done is think about you.
Stevie swallowed hard. He felt tears well up in his eyes. One left its birth and rolled down his cheek.
Steve, are you okay?
She asked.
Much better than that, Stella. I love you. No doubts, no bullshit.
Fuck, the money's running out. Don't ever mess me about, Steve. This is no fucking game. I'll see you at 11:15. I love you.
I love you. I love you.
The pips went and the line died. Stevie held the receiver tenderly, like it was something else, some part of her. Then he put it down and went and had that pee. He had never felt so alive. As he watched his fetid pish splash into the pan, his brain allowed itself to be overwhelmed with delicious thoughts. A powerful love for the world gripped him. It was New Year. Auld Lang Syne. He loved everyone, especially Stella and his friends at the party. His comrades. Warm-hearted rebels, the salt of the earth. Despite this, he even loved the Jambos. They were good people, just supporting their team. He'd first foot a lot of them this year, irrespective of the result. Stevie would enjoy taking Stella around the city to various parties. It would be brilliant. Football divisions were a stupid and irrelevant nonsense, acting against the interests of working-class unity, ensuring that the bourgeoisie's hegemony went unchallenged. Stevie had it all worked out. He went straight into the room and put the Proclaimers' Sunshine on Leith on the turntable. He wanted to celebrate the fact that wherever he went, this was his home, these were his people. After a few grumbles, it struck a chord. The catcalls at the previous record's removal were muted at the sight of Stevie's exuberance. He slapped Tommy, Rents and Beggar around vigorously, sang loudly and waltzed with Kelly, caring nothing about people's impressions of the obviousness of his transformation. "Nice of you to join us," Gav said to him. He was still high throughout the match, whereas for the others it went drastically wrong. Again, he became distanced from his friends. First, he couldn't share their happiness. Now, he couldn't relate to their despair. Hibs were losing to Hearts. Both teams were carving out ridiculous numbers of chances. It was schoolboy stuff, but Hearts were putting at least some of theirs away. Sick Boy's head was in his hands. Franco glared malevolently over towards the dancing Heart supporters at the other end of the ground. Rents shouted for the manager's resignation. Tommy and Sean were arguing about defensive shortcomings, trying to apportion blame for the goal. Gav cursed the referee's Masonic leanings, while Dawsey was still lamenting Hibbs' earlier misses. Spud, drugs, and second prize, alcohol, were bombed out of their boxes, still at the flat. Their match tickets good for nothing except future roach material. None of this mattered for the moment, as far as Stevie was concerned. He was in love. After the match, he left the rest of them to head to the station and meet Stella. The bulk of the Heart support were also headed up that way. Stevie was oblivious to the heavy vibes. One guy shouted in his face. The cunts won 4-1, he thought. What the fuck do they want? Blood! Obviously. Stevie survived some unimaginative taunting on the way up to the station. Surely, he thought, they could do better than Hibby Bastard or Fenian Cunt. One hero tried to trip him from behind, egged on by baying friends. He should have taken his scarf off. Who the fuck was to know? He was a London boy now. What did all this shite have to do with his life at the moment? He didn't even want to try and answer his own questions. On the station concourse, a group marched over to him. "Hibby bastard!" a youth shouted. "You've got it wrong, boys. I'm a Borussia Mönchengladbach man." He felt a blow on the side of his mouth and tasted blood. Some kicks were aimed at him as the group walked away from him. "Happy New Year, boys! Love and peace, Jambo brothers!" he laughed at them and sucked his sour, split lip. "Cunt's a fucking head case," one guy said. He thought they were going to come back for him, but they turned their attention to abusing an Asian woman and her two small children. "Fucking packy slag! Fuck off back to your own country!" They made a chorus of ape noises and gestures as they left the station. "What charming, sensitive young men," Stevie said to the woman, who looked at him like a rabbit looks at a weasel. She saw another white youth with slurred speech, bleeding and smelling of alcohol. Above all, she saw another football scarf, like the one worn by the youths who abused her. There was no colour difference as far as she was concerned, and she was right, Stevie realised with a grim sadness. It was probably just as likely to be guys in green who hassled her. Every support had its arseholes. The train was nearly 20 minutes late, an excellent performance by British Rail standards. Stevie wondered whether she'd be on it. Paranoia hit him. Waves of fear shuddered through his body. The stakes were high, the highest ever. He couldn't see her, couldn't even picture her in his mind's eye. Then she was almost upon him, different to how he thought of her, more real, even more beautiful. It was the smile, the look of emotion reciprocated. He ran the short distance to her and held her in his arms. They kissed for a long time. When they stopped, the platform was deserted and the train was well on its way to Dundee. Chapter 6. It Goes Without Saying. I hears the searin racket coming from outside the room. Sick boy, crashed out in the windy bay next to us, shoots to alertness like a dog that's heard a whistle. A shudder. That noise cut right through us. Leslie comes into the room screaming. It's horrible. I want her to stop. Now. I couldn't handle this. Nanny is good. No now. I never wanted anything more in my life than for her to stop screaming.
The bairn's away! The bairn's away! Dawn! Oh my God! Oh fucking God!
Was about all I could pick out of the horrible sound. She collapses onto the threadbare couch. My eyes stick on a brown stain on the wall above her. What the fuck was it? How did it get there? Sick boy was on his feet. His eyes bulged out like a frog's. That's what he reminded us, eh? A frog. It was the way he sort of hops up, becomes suddenly so mobile for a stationary position. He looks at Leslie for a few seconds, then gnashes through to the bedroom. Matty and Spud look around uncomprehendingly, but even through their junk haze, they ken that something really bad's happened. I ken't. Christ, I fucking knew, all right. I said what I always says when something bad happens. I'm cooking up in a bit, I tell them. Matty's eyes bore into us. He gives us the nod. Spud stands up and moves onto the couch, sitting a few feet for Leslie. Her head's in her hands. For a minute I thought that Spud would touch her. I hoped he would. I'm willing him to do it, but he just stares at her. I knew, even for here, that he'd be focusing on the big mole on her neck.
It's my fault! It's my fault!
She cries through her hands.
Eh, Les, let's see, Mark's cooking up, eh? You can, let's see, Spud says to her. It's the first words I can remember hearing him say for a few days. Obviously the cunt spoke an hour this period. He must have, surely, to fuck.
Sick boy comes back through. His body's straining, seemingly for the neck, as if against the limits of an invisible leash. He sounds terrible. His voice reminded us of the demons in the film The Exorcist. It shut us up.
Fuck. Some fucking life, eh? Something like this happened. What the fuck do you do, eh?
I've never seen him like this before, and I've kent the bastard practically all my life. What's wrong, Si? What's the fucking score? He moves towards us. I thought he was going to kick us. We're best mates, but we've hit each other before, in drink or rage, when one of us has wound the other up. Not serious, just sort of lashing out in anger. Mates can do that. No now, though. No with me starting to feel sick. My bones would have splintered into a million fragments had the cunt done that. He just stood over us. Thank fuck. Oh, thank you, sick boy. Simon.
The keg's fucked. It's all fucking fucked! He moans in a high, desperate whine. It was like a dug that had been run over and was waiting for some cunt to pit out its misery. Matty and Spud haul themselves up and go through to the bedroom. I follow, pushing past sick boy. I can feel death in the room before I even see the bairn. It was lying face down in its cot. She was cold indeed, blue around the eyes. I didn't have to touch her again. Just lying there like a discarded wee doll at the bottom of some kid's wardrobe. That wee, so fucking small. Wee Dawn, fucking shame. Wee Dawn, I can't believe it. Fucking sin, man, Matty says, shaking his head. Fucking heavy, this. Like, see him. Fuck. Spud pits his chin on his chest and exhales slowly. Matty's head's still shaking. He looks like he's gonna implode. I'm fucking right out of here, man. I can't fucking handle this. Fuck it, Matty. Nae cunt's leaving here the now, sick boy shouts. Stay cool, man. Stay cool, says Spud, which sounds anything but. We've got fucking gear stashed here. This street's been crawling with a fucking DS for weeks now. We fucking charge off now. We all fucking go down. There's police bastards every fucking where outside, says sick boy, struggling to compose his cell. Thoughts of police involvement always concentrated the mind. On the issue of drugs, we were classical liberals, vehemently opposed to state intervention in any form. Aye, but maybe we should get the fuck out of here. Leslie can get the ambulance or police once we've tidied up and fucked off. I still agreed with Matty. Hey, maybe we've got to stick with Leslie, see? Like mates and that, Ken? Spud ventures. That sort of solidarity seems a bit of a fanciful notion in the circumstances. Matty shakes his head again. He's just done 6 months in Socton. If he was done again, that would be him well fucked. Outside, though, there were pigs cruising about. At least that's how it felt. Sick boy's imagery had got to me more than Spud's pleas to stick together. Flushing all our gear down the lavvy was just not on. I'd rather get sent down. The way I see it, says Matty, is that it's Leslie's bairn, Ken. Maybe if she'd looked after it right, it might no be deed. How should we get involved? Sick boy starts hyperventilating. Hate to say it, but Matty's got a point, I says. I'm starting to hurt really badly. I just want to take a shot and fuck off. Sick boy's non-committal. This is weird. Normally the bastard's barking orders at every cunt in sight, whether they take any notice or no. Spud says, we can't lightsy leave Les here on her puff. I'd say, I mean, like, fuck. Ken what I mean? I'm looking at sick boy. We gied her the bairn, ask. Sick boy says nothing. Jimmy McGilvery, Matty says. Shite it, fucking whiz, sick boy dismissively sneers. Dinny you play Mr. Fucking Innocent, Matty turns on me. Eh, Monty fuck, what you on about, I respond, genuinely fucking perplexed at the bastard's outburst. You were there, Rents, Bob Sullivan's petty, he says. No, man, I've never been with Leslie. I'm telling the truth, which I realise is a mistake. In some company, people will always believe the opposite of what you tell them, particularly where sex is concerned. How come you were crashed out where in the morning at Sully's party? I was fucked, man. Out of my box. I couldn't have got a stiff neck where a doorstep is a pulley. I can't even remember the last time I had a ride. My explanation convinces them. They ken how long I've been using heavily and what that can mean in the shagging stakes. Somebody said it was, seekers, Spud suggests. Wasn't he seeker? Sick boy shakes his head. He puts a hand on the deed bairn's cold cheek. Tears are filling in his eyes. I'm going to greet an awe. There's a constricting tightness in my chest.
One mystery has been solved. Wee Dawn's dead face looks so obviously like my mate Simon Williamson's. Then Sick Boy pulls up his jacket sleeve, showing the weeping sores on his arm. I'm never touching that shite again. I'm fucking clean from now on. He puts on that wounded stag expression, which he always uses when he wants people to fuck or finance him. I almost believe